Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. Russia raises new questions about its support of Syria's leader. The Russian Foreign Ministry says the fate of embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad should be decided by the Syrian people, that keeping him in power is not crucial to Moscow's objectives. Speaking on Russian radio, spokeswoman Maria Zakharova said, "We never said Mr. Assad staying in power is a principled aspect of Russian policy." She said preservation of a functioning government is central to ending nearly 5 years of conflict. White House spokesman Josh Earnest Tuesday expressed doubt the statement reflects a change in the Kremlin's view, or that Moscow is prepared to change what he called its flawed strategy.
The fact is the Russians acknowledged the need for a political transition. This is something that President Putin and President Obama had the opportunity to discuss in New York a little over a month ago. President Putin, in the context of that meeting, affirmed for the president his commitment to the need for a political transition inside of Syria. The problem has been that he's engaged in a military strategy that undermines that political objective.
Washington insists the Syrian leader cannot be part of a long-term political solution. Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara was sworn in for his second five-year term Tuesday, pledging that more Ivorians will enjoy the benefits of the West African country's economic revival.
D'une Côte d'Ivoire en paix est en train de se réaliser.
Mr. Ouattara says our dream of a peaceful Ivory Coast is becoming a reality. He says lasting peace, strong institutions, and patriotism over self-interest will help vault the nation to the ranks of the great democracies. The Ivorian leader won a decisive victory in last month's election, taking 84% of the vote, the first national ballot since the post-election violence of 2010 that left some 3,000 dead. This is VOA News. Taiwan has announced that President Ma Ying-jeou will hold face-to-face talks with his Chinese counterpart, Xi Jinping, Saturday, the first meeting between the leaders of Taiwan and China since 1949. Mr. Ma's spokesman said the meeting would take place in Singapore and, quote, solidify Taiwan mainland relations and keep the status quo across the Taiwan Strait. Elizabeth Trudeau is a U.S. spokesperson.
We welcome the steps both sides of the Taiwan Strait have taken in recent years to reduce tensions and improve cross-strait relations. The United States has a deep and abiding interest in peace and stability in the Taiwan Strait. The benefits that stable and positive cross-strait ties have brought to both sides of the Taiwan Strait, the United States and the region, have been enormous. We encourage authorities in Beijing and Taipei to continue their constructive dialogue on the basis of dignity and respect.
A White House spokesman said U.S. policy remains committed to a one-China policy which recognizes a single Chinese government based in Beijing. But the U.S. remains obligated by law to come to the aid of Taiwan if the mainland uses force to keep the island from formally declaring independence. A U.S. military satellite detected a heat flash at the time a Russian jetliner crashed over the Sinai, but the cause of Saturday's mid-air breakup of the Metrojet A321 remains a mystery. Authorities have ruled out the possibility a missile hit the aircraft before plunging over 9,000 meters to the desert, killing all 224 on board. Experts say the heat flash could point to a bomb, explosion of an aircraft engine, or a fire, or even just the aircraft parts hitting the ground. Lawyers for South African Paralympian Oscar Pistorius, currently under house arrest in the death of his girlfriend, fought Tuesday to keep him from returning to prison as state prosecutors argued for a murder conviction. The case is before the South African Supreme Court of Appeal. Inez Benzudenhout is director of the law clinic at the University of Free State.
Difficult to say what will happen, but should the court say that the appeal stands and the charge be changed to that of murder, in that event, then the case will have to be referred back to the trial court for sentencing purposes, and we expect then that evidence be laid on sentence.
The 28-year-old Pistorius, released from prison to house arrest just a month ago, he's serving out the rest of a five-year term after being convicted of culpable homicide. Police in Zimbabwe have arrested three journalists, charging them with slander after publishing a front-page story implicating officials working with foreign nationals from Asia in the poisoning of dozens of elephants. Two Sunday Mail editors and a reporter were jailed Tuesday after officials said they communicated false statements prejudicial to the state. The arrests have been condemned by Amnesty International and the Voluntary Media Council of Zimbabwe. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate, Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's vice president says he's running to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in the 2017 presidential election.
The best wine comes with age. Age is not a handicap, it is a blessing. And I know I have the experience, and I know none of the people who are talking have to equal me in terms of what do they bring to government, what do they bring to leadership. I have all of those plus more.
That's Vice President Joseph Boakai of Liberia. Burundi says it will look for other markets now that President Barack Obama has removed Burundi from AGOA. Three Zimbabwe's state media journalists are jailed for publishing falsehoods, and a new report accuses Shell Oil Company of failure to clean up spills in Nigeria's Niger Delta region.
We saw streams that are still polluted. We saw oil sheen on the surface of water. We saw crude oil clearly visible in the environment.
That's Makmi Kamara of Amnesty International. Support staff and local contractors of the UN Interim Security Force for Abyei go on strike, and we'll discuss the World Bank's adjustment of the poverty line. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai says he's running to succeed President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf in the 2017 presidential election. He says he will be running on the Sirleaf government's record, which he touted to include 10 years of unbroken peace, infrastructure development, and freedom of the press. Critics say President Sirleaf's government, in power now for 10 years, has failed to deliver basic infrastructure development such as dependable electricity and running water. Vice President Boakai, who is nearly 71 years old, dismissed suggestions he's too old. He said age is not a handicap, but rather a blessing. He said he has more experience than any of his possible challengers.
The government has done well. I mean, if you check where Liberia is coming from, you know, people talk about doing well. But I know wherever I have been in this country, people start with saying at least 10 years of peace. That's the beginning. Without peace, you can achieve nothing. 10 years, Liberians now have not heard about political prisoners. They have not heard about gunshots. They can move about their business. Apart from that, you can see around the country freedom of the press. You can see around the country roads that are connecting in spite of all the challenges. You can see that governance structures are being put into place. That's what we're doing.
Now, what do you think, Mr. Vice President, those who say, Vice President Boakai is too old and he should not be given a chance?
And I say to them, the best wine comes with age. Age is not a handicap. It is a blessing. And I know I have the experience, and I know none of the people who are talking have to equal me in terms of what credentials they have, what do they bring to government, what do they bring to leadership. I have all of those plus more, so we can defend that effectively.
Do you think the ruling Unity Party is going to put you for, or there a competition within the ruling Unity Party?
I hope and I look forward to it. That the Unity Party will come 2016 will have me as the standard bearer.
Mr. Vice President, there's a constitutional conference that took place earlier this year, and there were some recommendations made. Some of the recommendations talk about the length of time that the president stays in office. Since you're going to be running for president, what do you think about that? You think that right now it's too long for the time that the president stays in power?
I believe Liberians will have to rethink. We are not America. We are not superpower. You take a president that is elected for 4 years, and you are going into an agreement like the Millennium Compact. If you take 2 years to go through that, by the time that agreement comes to be realized, out of government, Liberians and African countries should consider themselves as countries that are still trying to build. It's not like the U.S. where 4 years, they're not talking about road construction, they're not talking about negotiating on agreement that will. We are different. It's not about me. But the reality is that African countries, you talk about 4 years, even the cause of an election, after 4 years, by the time the second year, maybe you sign an agreement, you begin to implement that agreement, it's almost 2 years gone. Can you afford to finance election every 4 years in the midst of all of this?
And I take that to mean that you like the current length of time that the president stays in power.
If we had taken just 4 years and 8 years, by now, talking about peace, reconciliation, we would have been out of government by now, and you would have no result that would be able to serve the Liberian people. I'm not talking about power. I'm talking about what is real.
That's Liberia's Vice President Joseph Boakai speaking with me in Washington, D.C. Tomorrow, Thursday, the Vice President will discuss the signing in Washington of Liberia's Millennium Challenge Corporation Compact. The multinational petroleum company Shell has failed to clean up communities devastated by oil spills in Nigeria's Niger Delta, according to a report from Amnesty International. As Henry Richwell reports from London, Shell blames the continued pollution on oil theft and illegal refining.
The creeks around Bodo village in the Niger Delta run thick with oil from an old Shell pipeline. Like thousands of other villagers, Pastor Christian Lekoya Kapande used to rely on the Delta for his livelihood. His fish farm was destroyed by two major spills.
Shell have been here over 50 years. There is no infrastructure from them. But in 2008 and 2009, there were two massive oil spills which destroyed the livelihood of Bodo people. Bodo people are fishermen and farmer.
Oil leaked into Bodo Creek from the Trans-Niger pipeline for several weeks in 2008 until Shell repaired it. Shell blames those and later spills on locals tapping the pipeline to steal oil. Bodo is one of four sites investigated in the joint report from Amnesty International and a Nigerian NGO, the Center for Environment, Human Rights and Development.
We saw streams that are still polluted. We saw oil sheen on the surface of water. We saw crude oil clearly visible in the environment.
Kamara says the local communities are devastated.
They breathe contaminated air. They plant in polluted soil and they harvest polluted crops. And as a result, they can't feed their children with healthy food.
The United Nations Environment Programme exposed widespread oil pollution in the Ogoniland region of the Delta in 2011, describing it as an urgent public health risk. In response to Amnesty's report, a Shell spokesperson said Shell Petroleum Development Corporation is committed to cleaning up all spills from its facilities, irrespective of cause. The statement adds it is crucial to put an end to the widespread theft and illegal refining of crude oil. Amnesty wants more details on Shell's cleanup operations.
They should firstly produce a report, a comprehensive report that shows who cleaned, when it was cleaned, how it was cleaned, so that people can know.
Amnesty released its report ahead of the 20th anniversary of the execution of Ken Sarawiwa, who campaigned against the damage caused by the oil industry in the Niger Delta. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
Today's Wednesday, November 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 14 minutes past the hour. Burundi says it will look for other markets now that U.S. President Barack Obama has removed Burundi from the list of countries benefiting from AGOA, the agreement that gives certain African countries preferential access to U.S. markets. President Obama said he took the decision in response to what he called continuing crackdown on Burundi opposition members, including assassinations, extrajudicial killings, arbitrary arrests, and torture. Burundi's Foreign Minister Alain Nyamitwe says the decision will not have a big impact because not all the products Burundi was exporting to the United States are under AGOA.
I think one of the first reactions to it is that, of course, we respect the decision made by the president of a sovereign state, even if we are a direct victim of that decision. That's number one. But number two, our government has made a lot of efforts in the past for Burundi to be eligible in that scheme. I don't think we have exported much in that framework to the United States of America, but we were, you know, doing all we can to make sure that our people benefit from that scheme. Now that the decision has been made, we are not going to cry over it. We do our best to explore other markets. By the way, not all the products that are exportable to the United States of America were under the AGOA scheme. Some other products that we were exporting are still eligible to the market. So we believe that the decision will not have that big of an impact, if not a psychological and a political one.
This decision by President Obama does not take effect until January. But you also know, Mr. Minister, the European Union, which is a major trading partner and aid donor to Burundi, has also threatened sanctions over human rights violations in your country. I know your president said recently that he's given some ultimatum for people who are shooting or killing people to surrender by this Saturday. But people say this is a tit for tat. It's also being done by your government.
Let me begin by the second question that you have asked. Which government on earth would accept that illegally possessed weapons be continually used against security forces? Which one on earth do you know? I know none on earth that would accept that. So that is that the decision which was made, I think, and I believe goes in the line of saying, okay, there is a state which has to be respected, and whoever has a legally possessed weapon has to surrender. Now, on the issue vis-a-vis the European Union, I think that one has to be correct in putting things into context. The European Union has invited Burundi to participate in what they called Article 96 of the Cotonou Agreement, which indeed refers to human rights and the rule of law and good governance. Fine. But we have 30 days to ponder over the letter of invitation and come out with an answer whether we would agree to enter into those consultations or not. But we continue to believe that sanctions do not solve anything. Should there be any sanctions on Burundi, I do not think that the root of sanctions will solve any problem in the country.
Alain Nyamitwe is Burundi's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. The World Bank recently moved the established poverty line, meant to define who lives in poverty and who does not throughout the world, from $1.25 per day to $1.90 per day. While at first glance, this may seem like an increase, anthropologist Jason Hickel tells reporter Ricky Stryak that the move is actually a decrease from the previous rate when inflation and other factors are taken into consideration.
What they did is they rebased the line to the most recent purchasing power parity estimates, which are from 2011. And that's something the bank does every 10 years or so. The important thing here is that it's just an estimate, and it doesn't actually apply evenly across countries. So in some countries, it will seem as though the number of poor has decreased really dramatically. In other countries, it will seem like the number of poor has increased really dramatically. In this case, the rebasing means that it appears that there's fewer poor people in the world by about 100 million. And so the World Bank has announced a decrease the number of poor by 100 million, and it seems that this is because, you know, we're succeeding in reducing poverty, when in fact nothing has actually changed in the real world.
If $1.90 a day isn't a proper rate for the poverty line, what do you think might be and why?
Scholars have been arguing for many, many years that the $1.25 line from before was too low in the first place. It wasn't enough for basic nutrition. It wasn't enough for normal infant mortality rate. It wasn't enough for normal human life expectancy. It should probably be 2, 3, 4 times higher than it actually was. And so to watch the World Bank push the poverty line lower than it was before is like an insult to the scholarship on this issue. So this is not a fringe opinion. This is like scholarly consensus that the poverty line is too low. There's various ways you can think about alternatives to calculating poverty. One would be a country-by-country reporting system. You would get rid of the international poverty line altogether and instead calculate poverty by each country's own national poverty line. Another option is to use what scholars call an ethical poverty line, which essentially means what is the poverty line that would allow everyone in the world to achieve normal human life expectancy of about 70 years. And scholars calculate that would be about $7.40 a day, according to the new calculations. And that would show that the number of poor people in the world is about 4.2 billion people. And so that's, you know, that's more than four times as many people as the World Bank would have us believe.
How does this poverty line affect the policies that are developed on national and international levels?
So basically, over the past 15 years, the World Bank has been doing everything they can to make the poverty reduction trend seem better than it really is, right? So by pushing the poverty line lower repeatedly, or by changing the metrics so that the reduction trend looks better than it was before. And this has been really crucial for the UN Millennium Development Goals, which set itself the goal of cutting poverty in half, you know, by 2015. And now the SDGs has set the goal of eradicating poverty. If you make it seem as though there are fewer poor people in the world than there really are, then these goals are easier to achieve without much effort at all.
Jason Hickel is an anthropologist at the London School of Economics. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from London. A Zimbabwean lawyer representing three state media journalists arrested Monday on allegations of publishing and peddling falsehoods says his clients are being forced by the police to reveal their sources and the name of a senior police officer they alleged was involved in poaching activities in the Wange National Park. Attorney James Muzangaza says the journalists are being charged under the Criminal Law Codification Act. He says his clients are expected to appear in court today, Wednesday.
They have since been charged with a contravention of Section 31, paragraph A, subparagraph 2 of the Criminal Law Codification and Reform Act, Chapter 9.23, which is basically the publication of falsehoods that have got an effect on the economic interests of the country, that is Zimbabwe. They have since had statements recorded from each of them in which they basically deny the charges. They are due to appear at the Harare Magistrates Court tomorrow morning for initial remand or alternatively for placement on remand. That is when we will also apply for bail. The proceedings tomorrow are basically the placement on remand and the application for their admission to bail.
Where are they being currently held?
Right now they are held at Harare Central Police Station. I saw them this morning when I attended for the recording of the warrant and question statement. They were all in good spirits. They have no complaints against the police.
Do you think that it's constitutional for the police to arrest the reporters who are doing their job?
We are seriously looking at the possibility of challenging the constitutionality of that statute. There has already been a challenge before the Supreme Court and also the Constitutional Court, the result of which a part of this very same statute was struck down as unconstitutional. And this part that relates to the economic interests of Zimbabwe remains on our law books. But again, anybody can challenge it, and the opportunity has presented itself with the arrest and the charges being brought against these three gentlemen from Zimbabwe newspapers.
That was Attorney James Muzangaza speaking from Harare with reporter Jonga Kandimiri of US Zimbabwe Service. Support staff and local contractors at the United Nations Interim Security Force for Abyei, also known as UNISFA, is on strike to protest what they say is the UN's refusal to pay them in US dollars. More than 300 UNISFA employees say they will only return to work after their demands are met. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Wau in South Sudan.
Local UNISFA workers clean buildings, provide security, prepare food and disseminate information to reporters and the public, just to name a few of things they do. UNISFA employees in Abyei say not only should they be paid in US dollars, but complain that UNISFA pays their counterparts in Kadugli, South Kordofan State, higher salaries. Deng Bor, head of the national staff at UNISFA, says the economic hardship facing people in the region prompted workers to go on a strike for better pay. He says with skyrocketing commodity prices, local staff can no longer afford to feed their families on their current salaries.
But what we want is just a payment in US dollar, because Abyei is in the middle. It is an administrative area. It is neither north nor south. And we are facing difficulties here in terms of feeding our families and some other services.
Kol Manuet, another UNISFA employee, says the declining value of the South Sudanese pounds against the US dollar is making it very difficult to pay for basic necessities.
The exchange rate is very high, And some of us, the children, they are outside South Sudan. And when we change this amount with SSP, it will get less than what to help our families.
Nyan Chol Chol works as an assistant for one of UNISFA's contractors. She says local contractors and employees first raised this kind of complaints in March, but UNISFA all ignored their demands.
This issue started a long time ago with a UNISFA administration whereby our staff were being paid low compared to the staff in Kadugli and other areas in northern Sudan working with UNISFA.
Bor says local staff and contractors will not go back to work until UNISFA starts paying them in U.S. dollars. UNISFA spokesman Daniek Adekera says the UNISFA administration is aware of the concerns raised by its local staff and is trying to address them.
Well, it's not exactly correct that there has not been any response so far. Engaged in a series of discussions, we were in touch with New York to put their position across, and so far the response we've received from New York is positive.
Knowing that UNISFA is working on the problem, Adekera says he hopes local staff and contractors will end their strike and return to work in the next few days. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in WOW.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with disability sport. Algeria beat South Africa 48-29 in the women's contest at the Africa Wheelchair Basketball Championships in the Algerian capital Algiers on Tuesday. In earlier men's matches, Algeria beat Egypt 67-58, Morocco edged Nigeria 59-52, and South Africa overpowered Libya 103-28. The contest is the Africa qualifier for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Paralympics in Brazil. Turning to football, Botswana will host Mauritius in the opening leg of their qualifiers for the 2016 Women's Africa Cup of Nations, the Confederation of African Football disclosed in Cairo, Egypt on Tuesday. Zambia face Namibia, Mali play Morocco, Tanzania face Zimbabwe, Algeria engage Togo, and Senegal meet Guinea. Elsewhere, Kenya welcome the Democratic Republic of Congo, Libya encounter Egypt, and Burkina Faso tackle Tunisia. According to the draws, Equatorial Guinea, Ghana, South Africa, and defending champions Nigeria get a bye to the second round of the qualifiers. The contest starts in March next year. In motorsports, Ugandan rally navigator and sports journalist Leon Senyange was voted the Nile Special Uganda Sports Press Association USPA Sports Personality of the Month for October in Kampala, Uganda. Senyange and driver Ronald Sebuguzi earned the accolade for winning the Uganda Independence Rally last month. The event was part of Uganda's Independence Day celebration on the 9th of October. Finally, in basketball, 12 teams converge in Benin's capital Cotonou for the Africa FIBA Zone 3 Basketball Club Championships today, Wednesday. This is the region's qualifier for the Africa Men's and Women's Club Championships due next year. The men's contest features two teams each from Burkina Faso, Ghana, and Nigeria, as well as one each from Benin and Liberia. In the women's competition, there are two teams from Nigeria and one each from Benin and Burkina Faso. And that's it for today. Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And that's it for this Wednesday, November 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, we'll explore the secrets of doing business in Africa from an American corporate executive's perspective. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they share how U.S. companies can best play catch-up with the fastest-growing continent. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on the Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time,
with David Bandy.